This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Like the kōkako, the saddleback, or te eke, belongs to the New Zealand wattlebird family. A family to which the huia belonged and which has been established in this country since ancient times, much longer than most of our other birds. The saddleback takes its name from the bright reddish saddle on its back, which according to legend is the mark of Maui's hand. Sadly, this attractive bird has disappeared from the main islands and exists only on a few offshore islands, carefully chosen locations for resettlement away from predators, which appears to have saved the te eke from total extinction.
Community or chaos? We can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.nz.
Good morning, friends. Today we have Dr. Reverend Graham Redding, who's the minister at Knox Church and also a lecturer in chaplaincy at the University of Otago. He's an ordained Presbyterian minister and former moderator. And we'll be talking about the multiple crises that the world's facing and our civilization's facing, and what are some of the roots of those crises, and what are the ideological and spiritual basis both for the crisis and maybe attempts at solutions. Briefly, Graham, how were you called to the ministry and why did you decide to become a lecturer in chaplaincy studies?
Thanks, Marvin, for having me on your show. I was brought up in Auckland within a family that had little or no church connection, so I had really no exposure to religion or Christianity in particular. It wasn't until I was studying commerce at Auckland University that I had an encounter with the divine, and as a result of that, sought out a faith community, and I ended up in a Presbyterian church in Auckland, aged about 19 going on 20. And I completed my accountancy studies. I worked as an auditor for a large chartered accountancy firm, completed my professional qualifications. And then at the end of that time, I thought, not having been brought up in the church, I had huge gaps in my understanding of the Bible, of theology, of church and world history. I'd studied commerce, which was a very practical and functional degree, but didn't really expand the mind. So while a lot of my friends were off doing their OE, I decided to come to Otago and do a theology degree at Knox Theological Hall, as it was then, and through the university. And it was towards the end of that degree that a number of people who I'd come to know down here encouraged me to apply for the ministry in the Presbyterian Church, which I did. I was accepted, did some additional study, and that set me on a pathway of ordination within the Presbyterian Church. I served in parishes in Auckland and Wellington. And then in 2007, came back down to Dunedin to be principal of what used to be the Theological Hall and had then become the Knox Centre for Ministry and Leadership. And I did that for 6 or 7 years, and then I took on the role as head or master of Knox College, the residential part of the college. And after being there about 5 or 6 years, the position came up at the university. They were creating a new full-time lectureship in chaplaincy studies. And that appealed to me because I guess in a lot of my work at Knox College and elsewhere, there'd been a strong community-facing aspect to my ministry. And I didn't see my ministry as being confined within the church, speaking to the church, but was very interested in what was happening in the wider world and in the community at large. And it seemed to me that the various forms of chaplaincy that we see, whether it be in hospitals in prisons and the police and community chaplaincies, they're very much outward looking, the interface of faith and secular society. And so that's what drew me to the field of chaplaincy studies. I applied for the position and was given it. So that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years, is really establishing that chaplaincy studies program.
Well, the last 40 years, I would say, we've seen a real decline of younger people and people generally attending and taking part in the more liberal mainline churches. But in the last 5 years or so, in particularly in Great Britain and in America in a distinctive way, you've seen a return of young people to various forms of Christianity and spirituality. And you wrote an article in the ODT about people returning to faith, but what faith are they turning to? Can you talk about that article?
Yeah, what prompted that was initially a survey was done and a study was done, an international one, that was talking about the surge in numbers of youth and young adults coming to faith and coming to the church. And there was almost a triumphalistic tone to this. Look, the church is going through a phase of renewal and refreshment. And even though that study came to be questioned in terms of some of its assumptions and some of its data, I think anecdotally there was still a lot of evidence coming in that a lot of churches are experiencing growth, and I'm experiencing it at Knox Church as well with precisely that age group. But it struck me that rather than just interpreting it narrowly as a kind of renewal movement within the church, we need to reflect more widely and deeply on what we're observing. So my main point in that article about people returning to faith is that claims need to be handled carefully. The important question for me is not simply whether there is renewed interest in religion, but what kind of faith is being embraced. Because we see overseas, particularly in North America, some extremes of that with Christian nationalism and the rise of the evangelical movement, with some very concerning aspects around what we're observing. So in that article, I noted that globally, religion has never really disappeared. Christianity remains numerically large. Islam is growing rapidly. And the center of gravity of world Christianity has shifted away from Europe and North America towards places such as sub-Saharan Africa, Latin America, and parts of Asia. So what I wanted to do was put it in a global context. What may feel like a religious revival in the West is actually part of a much larger global story. I also suggested in the article that there are at least two very different possibilities behind renewed interest. One is that younger people, weary of consumerism, digital fragmentation, loneliness, and perhaps the thinness of contemporary culture, are searching for depth, for community, for meaning, and for hope. In that sense, I think faith can be a healthy response to what is an increasing spiritual hunger. But, I point out in the article, there's another possibility. In anxious times, which we also live in today with multiple global crises, religion can also become a search for certainty, identity, and hard boundaries. It can take rigid or exclusionary forms aligning with culture war politics or reactionary impulses. And that's why, for me, religious growth is not automatically good news. We need to ask whether a faith tradition is forming people in compassion, humility, truthfulness, and concern for the common good, or whether it's simply reinforcing fear and division. So in sum, my article was really a call for discernment. Faith can help renew society, but it can also be distorted. The key question is not numbers in pews, but the kind of people and the kind of society that faith is helping to build.
I'd ask you to make a guess. It's not one of the things that we talked about, but why do you think Islam's growing quite fast?
Well, from the research that I've done, a lot of it is to do with birth rates and areas of the world. So it's not necessarily conversion we're talking around. It's around large families and growth rates and so on. So a lot of it is to do with birth and geographical demographics.
Demographics is an interesting subject in some ways because I'm aware that in Italy and Spain, I'm aware that the Catholic Church until recently didn't really discourage population growth. I think I'm being fair to them. But in Spain and Italy, they're worried about their population shrinking. Now, maybe it's good for the world, I think, when populations shrink, but it's not necessarily easy for countries because you get the more older people than young people and more people that are less able to work, but you also have a greater chance of civilization adapting to climate change and overshoot of all our resources. What are some of the roots of, well, it seems to me that one of the greatest problems we have is two things. One thing, the idealization of autonomy, self-assertion. You see this if you look at somebody like Musk or Peter Thiel. They're both very successful entrepreneurs, and they're very successful in science. But I'm not sure I'd like to see them as models for the future. But doesn't this to some extent go back to two things? The Enlightenment, where humanity is the meaning of all things, and also to the Protestant Reformation, which encouraged entrepreneurship and even marked it as a sign of God's grace.
Yeah, if I can comment on those things, on the Enlightenment and the Reformation, I think that while both brought great advances, in the case of the Enlightenment, it heralded an age of scientific progress and the power of logic and human reason, which we can trace a lot of modern benefits back to, I think, in terms of society and the things we take for granted. And the Reformation, for its part, encouraged individual thinking and conscience before God, so no longer reliant on a central institution called the church to mediate all that, but rather encouraging people to read the Bible for themselves, discern what God was saying. And that, too, brought huge benefits, not least of which was the increased literacy rate, encouraging people to read for themselves, which had educational benefits which flowed on. But the flip side to a lot of that was a rampant individualism that was unleashed, loosening the bonds of what held society together and encouraging that individual autonomy of which you spoke. You harness that to the kind of so-called Protestant work ethic, where personal autonomy is linked to personal advancement, the myth of the self-made man or the self-made person. All of that flowed out of that Reformation Enlightenment era. And I think that while we see some of the benefits of that, these days we're also seeing with the global crises, the inequalities of wealth, the sheer cost to that kind of human paradigm shift.
The Reformation was divided itself, wasn't it? You had the radical Reformation, the Mennonites, for instance, and Quakers and other groups that were more collective in their response to the kind of changes they wanted in religion. But the mainline Protestant Reformation was more comfortable for those that already had power and wealth. And so they supported that aspect of the Reformation. Is that fair?
I'm not a church historian, so I feel a little bit out of my depth talking about analysing aspects of the Reformation. I think in broad terms, you're probably right. I think the more radical Reformation such as the Peasants' Revolt and the birth of the Quaker movement and the Anabaptist movement, they really emerged from the fringes of society more, in my understanding, whereas the mainstream Reformation was still around the reform of the, if you like, the reform of the establishment, from within the establishment. And even though it led to fragmentation, there was still a basic doctrinal and societal core that was being preserved.
What do you think of the theology of abundance and prosperity?
Oh, the prosperity gospel. I think it's got huge it's got huge warning signals that we need to be very careful about. I want to link that question to Christian nationalism, because Christian nationalism is what happens when Christianity is harnessed to national identity, cultural grievance, or political power. It turns faith into a badge of belonging, that God is on our side. And I think the prosperity gospel does something similar economically. It treats God as a guarantor of success, wealth, and personal advancement. So churches that preach the prosperity gospel, I think, actually work with a very distorted view of the gospel. There are passages, particularly in the Hebrew Scriptures, the Old Testament, that do link, if you like, prosperity with obedience to God's will. But that's not the God we see in the person of Jesus in the New Testament. So Christian nationalism and the prosperity gospel, for me, both distort the Christian message. In the Gospels, Jesus doesn't bless domination or greed. He speaks of service, mercy, neighbor love, peacemaking, and concern for the poor. So those, for me, are the markers of authentic Christian faith.
To me, the Hebrew Bible is a mixture, because it's not just one book.
Correct.
I mean, it's dozens of books, and the groups who offered the books were living in different circumstances. I mean, the prophets may have thought quite differently than King David, for obvious reasons.
Yeah. And that's exactly right.
For instance, you had the Jubilee year, which was the ideal. Maybe it was never fully acted on, but the idea of redistributing wealth every 7 years and freeing slaves every 7 years. Yeah. I don't have the detail of that in my brains, but that was the general idea. And it's probably something that wasn't allowed to happen. It's like some of the things in the American Constitution or in socialism. You got the ideal and you've got the practice of the ideal.
That's exactly right. And I think what biblical scholars tell us is there's a number of things in the Scriptures that were proclaimed or declared, but there's no historical evidence they were ever actually applied for any significant length of time. And so the year of Jubilee tradition was one aspect of that. But I think even though that might be the case historically, that there's little evidence of it ever actually applying, it doesn't mean it can't continue to inform our social imagination.
It informed Jesus' social imagination. And his first sermon was on the Jubilee year.
Exactly, where he declared the year of the Lord's favor, it has arrived. So these things must impact, I think, on the Christian conscience and on our social commitments, to say these are not just fringe things, they were very much at the heart of Jesus' teaching itself.
In some way, didn't Jesus' teaching and the community he was trying to build, wasn't that an alternative to the Roman Empire or to empire generally? Because ordinary people, their condition in life was even worse than ordinary people in poor countries now.
Yes, it was. And I think when you look at things like the Beatitudes that Jesus taught in Matthew 5 and Luke's Gospel, you realize there was so much that was countercultural, counterintuitive, and counter-empire in its understanding. And so the way the Gospels are presented, Jesus, if you like, is the antidote to empire kind of politics and empire kind of theology. And that's, in the end, what got Jesus killed, was challenging both the religious and the political powers of his day with this very much countercultural movement that was growing in and around him.
In some ways, Jewish society was very unstable. You had groups that were unhappy with the double taxation that peasants endured, both from the Jerusalem authorities and from the Roman authorities, and the overwhelming pride and strength of the Roman Empire. In a way, it isn't any surprise that Jesus would be crucified. Thousands of people were crucified by the Roman Empire. And I think it's sad that in many cases, the entire blame for the crucifixion of Jesus was put on the Jews, when the only people who could crucify a person were the Roman Empire, and it wasn't exceptional that they crucified Jesus.
I think you put your finger on an important point, insofar as when you read the Gospels, there is the historical particularity that Jesus was a Jew, and many of the Jewish leaders at the time were complicit in his judgment and in his death. But it wasn't all about the Jews. It was Jews under Roman rule and within a Roman system of empire.
It's like the French during the occupation of German occupation, who many of the authorities that are under Pétain actually helped the Nazis round up Jews for the concentration camps. But that doesn't mean the entire French population supported the concentration camps.
Correct. And that is why within the Christian tradition, we have to be very careful we don't allow that historical particularity to actually become a breeding ground for anti-Semitism, which it has done over the years, where the Jews have been blamed for Jesus' death carte blanche. But I think John's Gospel in particular has to be read with great care, so we don't allow it to foster that anti-Semitism that's always lying there just below the surface.
What were some of the aspects of the Beatitudes, and also his saying, "When you didn't do it unto them, you didn't do it unto me," and vice versa. What are some of the aspects of the Beatitudes and his other sayings that might offend powerful, wealthy people even now?
Well, I think the kind of where God's blessing is associated with those who are persecuted, with the peacemakers, with the meek, all these people God says will inherit the earth, God blesses. And it's not about a future prediction. It's saying God blesses them where they are now. In other words, if you talk about if God is on the side of a particular group or category of people, what Jesus was saying is God blesses these people who represent the underside of history. So not the people at the top, not who those who write the narratives of history and in control power, but those who are often the victims of those historical events. And I think that itself was radical. It showed, if you like, where the impulse of the gospel was taking root. And that would be a threat to those in power.
What kind of changes do we need in our society today? It seems to me that in some ways, one of the reasons for our lack of care for the environment and so on is the fact that very few things are considered sacred. And since Descartes and Newton, we've scientifically looked at the world. There's a physical world and there's a spiritual world, and they're separate. And a lot of people would, both Christians and Buddhists and Jews, like Martin Buber, and some scientists, particularly physicists would say there's one universe, one reality. There can't be a separation between the physical and the spiritual.
Yeah. My understanding is that modernity, which is what we are the products of, brought extraordinary gains. We talked earlier about the Enlightenment. It brought science, advances in medicine, technology, critical thinking. All these things can be traced back to that Enlightenment.
If you question it, you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Correct. And so I think we've got to be grateful for those very benefits. But modernity also encouraged certain habits of mind, to see the world as mechanism, imagining the self as isolated and treating nature as raw material, something to be exploited. We became skilled at analysis, but weaker at wisdom. We learned how things work, but not always what they are for. Now, religious traditions, including Christianity, I think, at best resist that split. The biblical vision is not spirit versus matter, but creation as sacred gift. Human beings are not solitary consumers, but relational creatures bound to neighbor, to earth, and ultimately to God. So the problem for me isn't science. The problem is when scientific method becomes a total worldview, unable to speak of meaning, beauty, love, or moral obligation. So when you talk around the oneness of the universe, I agree with that in a sense, because what that works towards is an integrated understanding of reality, which I think we need to recover, provided that it doesn't collapse the distinction between God and creation. That I think in the biblical worldview, God is utterly bound up with creation as its creator, but is also distinct from it. If we collapse the distinction and where we simply see God in everything, that becomes a form of panentheism that I think can be equally problematic. So I agree with you in part about the oneness of things, but I would still want to preserve the distinction between creator and creation.
Talking about God's very difficult, I think, because we're persons. And we tend to see the things as things, which is one way of seeing world, particularly, or we tend to see in persons. And so that makes it hard to talk about God, because God's not a thing, but God's not exactly a person either, in the sense that we see persons.
Well, except, Marvin, I think the Christian claim is that God did become a person in Jesus Christ. Okay. And so even though Jesus... It's not like sitting across the table from you and I where we can see Jesus as such. There is that understanding of incarnation that God did become a human. So when we read about Jesus in the Gospels, it seems to me we're not only reading about a God who came among us, but we're also reading about what it means to be fully and truly human in the life of Jesus. So I think there are hints and glimpses of what it means to be fully human as we hold up that image, that gospel portrayal of Jesus. And so I think we can speak with confidence about God becoming known to us.
To me, I'm fairly heretical, that when we look at Jesus and we look at the experience of the disciples after his crucifixion, we're looking at Jesus and man, we're looking about his relationship to God, which I suspect happened gradually. And we're looking at God's, or the spiritual reaction to Jesus, especially during and after the crucifixion, where his oneness with God that mystics have to a certain extent, didn't disappear, it grew greater.
Yeah, I agree with you again in part. I think that I agree with you where you say that Jesus' self-understanding grew gradually. I think that's true. To say that doesn't dishonor Scripture, but what it does is honor his humanity. It was not a false humanity. He grew as we did. And so his adopting of his mission, his messianic understanding, I don't think was there from birth. It was something that he grew into as he grew older and began to see what God was doing in and through him. So I fully agree with you there. In terms of what happened after he died, the Gospels are quite emphatic about the resurrection, around the witnessing to the resurrection, that the one who was crucified was raised from the dead. And although I know that raises a number of questions for the modern mind around how can that be and what does it represent, I think there is a sense in which, from the gospel perspective, there is something absolutely pivotal about this man Jesus in his life, his death, and his resurrection as testified to in Scripture. That becomes vitally important for our understanding not only of God, but of what it means to be human.
When we're talking about Jesus, is it beliefs about Jesus or how we live our lives and how we follow Jesus' teachings? Of course, you're not going to take the way of Jesus or follow Jesus if you don't believe in him. I mean, the reason I followed Martin Luther King is I believed in Martin Luther King, and I still do.
Yeah.
So there's it's not an absolute dichotomy.
No, it's not. I think it's not one or the other. It's not about belief in Jesus or about the way we live our lives. It's both, but I think the order is important. Christian belief is not merely accepting a set of propositions. It is trust in the character and the way of Jesus as testified to in Scripture. But genuine trust implies practice. You don't just trust with your head alone. You trust by your actions and what follows. So Jesus doesn't simply ask, "What do you think of me?" He says, "Follow me." And that means forgiveness, truthfulness, generosity, courage, solidarity with the vulnerable. All these things, as they're lived out, show what we truly believe about Jesus and about being human. So, but for me, belief without discipleship can become empty orthodoxy, where we're simply believing a set of propositions because we're told to believe. Action without grounding can become activism without the depth. For me, Christianity joins both conviction and transformation.
How we speak about our values and how we enact them has become critical, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it seems to me in the last 40 years, we've seen a great increase in inequality in the developed world. And we've also seen that politics has been formed by two groups mainly. They're very wealthy, the business community, and the intellectual elite, people that have been through university and have their doctor's degrees and speak from that experience. And sometimes, not always respect for people who disagreed with them or have different life experience and different attitudes. My own experience as a Quaker in some ways is like that. Though I haven't been to university, but when I first started coming to Friends in the United States, all I thought all Friends meetings were liberal, and all Friends meetings didn't have paid ministers or pastors. And I found that was not the case. And I found out when I went to Kenya, for instance, that evangelical friends who had paid ministers and pastors who were very evangelical also withstood genocide in Burundi and Rwanda. Not only withstood it, they led in reconciliation and forgiveness after the genocide, even though so many of them families were killed and so I think we have to be careful how we see people we disagree with sometimes.
That's right.
I'm aware that in the late 19th century and early, actually late 18th century and through most of the 19th century, evangelical Christians led the fight against for the abolition of slavery, and many progressive movements until the 20th century, which changed. How do we actually talk to people and listen to people in ways that where we support the things we value and so on, but realize that we can be wrong, but also that we're listening and we respect the people we're disagreeing with.
Mm. There's a lot in what you ask there. I want to pick up several threads. First of all, you talked near the beginning about the elites, the meritocracy, if you were. And I think there is a real danger when societies become governed by credentialed elites who mistake expertise for wisdom and treat ordinary people with condescension. I think there's a real danger. I think expert knowledge does matter. We need our scientists, our teachers, our doctors, our economists. But intelligence is not confined to universities. And you said you're yourself not a university graduate. And I think that's a good thing. Intelligence is not confined to universities. There is such a thing as practical wisdom, moral wisdom, relational wisdom, and the kind of understanding that can only come through suffering, through work, through failure and perseverance, life experience. And we need to honour that. In some ways, this for me, this reflects an old contrast between Greek and Hebrew traditions of wisdom. In the classical Greek world, wisdom often was associated with the educated elite, with philosophers, with rhetoric, with abstract reasoning. It was the possession of the elite. By contrast, Hebrew wisdom, especially in books like Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and Job, is grounded in lived experience of family life, work, justice, grief, neighborliness, the seasons of life, and learning how to walk well before God, earthy, practical, and moral. It seems to me that Christian tradition inherits both streams, but Jesus consistently dignified those who were overlooked by the status systems of his day. He drew examples from farmers, laborers, widows, children, shepherds, and the poor. He often exposed the blindness of those who assumed education or rank automatically made them wise. And in that context, I think your Quaker example is powerful. People who endured violence and still chose forgiveness may understand the gospel more deeply than those with polished educational theories. Those evangelical friends in Rwanda and Burundi embodied truths many of us only discuss. So for me, churches must be places where dignity is restored across class and educational divides, where expertise is valued but never worshipped, and where every person is heard not because they are impressive, but because they bear the image of God. And for me, that's the bottom line.
Is one of the problems we face in the Western world a sort of not believing in anything, almost a nihilism?
Yep, I think that's right.
I'm not sure. I mean, I'm not sure how to deal with that. Theoretically, it's one thing we can easy to deal with theoretically, perhaps, but in reality, how do we build a belief without building ideology?
It's a good question. I think there has been a cultural drift toward believing that only what can be measured is real. But the most important things in life can't be reduced to those metrics: love, trust, beauty, grief, conscience, and hope. A civilization that recognizes only the measurable and the tangible can, I think, become spiritually malnourished. So for me, that doesn't mean abandoning reason. What it does mean is recognizing that reason has its limits. We learn a lot from poetry, from worship, from silence, from art, from friendship, and sacrifice. All these things disclose truths that traditional metrics of knowledge cannot do. When meaning collapses, it seems to me nihilism fills the vacuum. People then seek intensity, distraction, or ideology. The task for us today is to recover depth so that people don't just opt for simplistic answers and solutions.
It seems to me that when you disavow science and totally, for instance, we have a huge history of vaccination against smallpox, against polio. It goes back well over nearly 200 years of smallpox. And then you get people saying that somehow vaccinations are the spawn of a secret elite that are trying to destroy us. And you get the same thing with other aspects of climate change denial. And actually, it's quite easy with climate change denial because you know that was started by the... this may sound conspiratorial, but we actually have evidence the first climate change, effective climate change denial politically was from the oil and coal companies and the Tea Party. And the same thing that happened with cigarettes and cancer. It's important, I think, to represent the common good, not necessarily the cigarette companies or the coal companies. Is the common good a way forward? Because society has to change. I mean, we're going to face huge social, economic, and physical change with climate change, which we're not addressing. Not just climate change, environmental overreach. We use too much of the Earth's resources for too few people. But also, it isn't just that. We probably are overpopulated as well.
I think you're right.
Going to face these crises. We're not going to escape them.
No. You referred to the common good. The problem that I see is that what constitutes the common good has become increasingly contested, and it's divided along political and ideological lines. So, for example, in the United States of America, Democrat, Republican, where the lines are quite, I think, increasingly sharply defined, there is very little agreement now on what constitutes the common good. Everything is politicized. You combine that with the anti-science kind of mentality, the conspiracy theorists who believe that elites are ruling the world, and it's very difficult to find consensus on what constitutes the common good. So somehow we need to have a conversation that talks about these ideological divisions and the impact that they're having on being able to find a common way forward together.
In some ways, I think the Democratic Party made a huge mistake when they didn't support Bernie Sanders, because I think his concern for the common good was stronger than any ideology he held. He was a Jewish person who grew up in a Jewish family and very much Jewish socially and family-wise, but questions what Israel was doing in Gaza. But I think the Democrats were more afraid of him than they were of Trump.
And I'm not an expert on American politics, and I don't know much about
Sanders. The members of the party. The funding of the politics in America, but in the West generally, particularly the English-speaking countries.
But I think you've put your finger on a dilemma that a lot of the centrist and central-left political parties around the world have. They're a very broad tent, and they have within their ranks those that are quite radically left in their political leanings and those who are more centrist.
But Bernie Sanders in Europe would have been considered centrist.
Yeah. But in terms of American politics, he was regarded as being very much to the left.
That's right.
And the power brokers of the Democratic Party have to try to work out, well, where are our votes going to come from?
But also, where is our money coming from?
Correct. And so these trade-offs are made and these decisions are made for the sake of power and pathways to power, which means some of the best voices in politics will not necessarily be given the backing that they need because they're deemed to be too extreme in one area or another. So I would see Bernie Sanders as an example of institutional politics being played out on the centre-left spectrum.
I think you saw this earlier in a more subtle way, or in a crueler way too, with Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King was trying to organize poor people across racial lines. And he died for it. We have to find a way of, if we're going to, we're not going to have a future of more and more abundance, more and more people owning cars, more and more people traveling, flying freely. I mean, that's good or bad. It's not going to continue. It'll continue in my lifetime because I'm in my 80s. But our use of resources and our waste of resources has to stop, and it'll either stop because we're wise enough to change, or it'll stop because the biosystem will stop it.
Yep, and I think that that comes back to what we were talking
about. But how do we face this change in a way that doesn't divide us, that doesn't, where people feel like we're suffering, but we're suffering fairly? I mean, like the English in the World War II, English working class actually ate better than they had just before the war because of rationing. And they united partially because they were, the government recognized that they had to take cognizance of the, all the people in England, including the working class, the majority, in their rationing and other things they did. And now we're not facing, hopefully, we're not facing a war. So that's less doubtful, more doubtful than it was 5 years ago. But we are certainly facing a crisis that will be as difficult as war, as any war we've fought.
We've got the situation today where you've got several interlocking crises. You've got economic crisis. You've got global warming, climate change as a crisis. You've got unbridled power on the geopolitical stage between three or four major players. The old rules-based order is disintegrating. So you've got all these crises that are interlocking. And to come back to the original thing in our conversation around where are young people in all this, I think that's one reason why young people are looking for an alternative. They want a different kind of moral imagination that can give them hope, and also undergird their desire for change. And that's where older religious traditions, including what strands of Christianity can offer, is proving appealing for a number of young people because they're actually seeing threads of hope, ancient hope, that can speak into the modern situation.
In some ways, couldn't an attitude of the common good be one of those threads?
Yeah.
And the idea that the common good can be as equalitarian as socialism in some respects, but it's broader.
Yeah.
And it also has to include creation or the environment that we're all part of.
Yes, I think the common good will be an increasingly important part of the conversation.
But we don't talk about it much.
No, we don't. And that's because the market square, the public square, has become very fragmented. And I think social media has exacerbated that, where we talk across the divide rather than meeting in the common ground to talk in a civilized way. So keyboard warriors fire off quite rhetorical and antagonistic kind of messages against the so-called opposite side, but there's not a meeting of minds in that traditional public square sense.
I agree with that, and I think they're a symptom of where we are, but also think they're a symptom because I think the divide was there before the internet became what it is today. I think Facebook is, and that is a symptom, but it's not the cause.
Yeah.
I think you had the inequality growing, certainly since the 70s in the English-speaking world, and you've had the fact that decision-making and how we think and what we think is right has centered on the idea of expertise and also the idea of power and wealth.
Yeah.
And because we know what's best for ordinary people, we don't have to worry about or listen to ordinary people.
Yeah, I think that's right. So coming back to your original thing about young people, Marvin, let me ask you, what do you think young people are looking for in the midst of this?
I think they're looking for a solid ground, for one thing. I think they know in some way, many know that they may not know there's truth, but they know that the lack of truth and the lack of honesty, both truth in the deeper sense, that in the meaning of life and life and creation being meaningful, not just throw at the dice, but also the idea that we should speak the truth. I think they know that, and they need and they want solid ground, and they want certain things that they can believe in.
I would go one step further. They're not only looking for things they can believe in, they're looking for a community that they can invest in and belong in, where these notions of truth are being fleshed out in practices that are actually making a difference. So there is a search for not just solid ground, but a community of faith or belief or practice that constitutes that solid ground for them.
I think you're right. Yes. And also, I noticed something that in the last 8 years or so, our last great crisis, the crisis economic and social that I was born in 42. And I saw pictures of the liberation of Dachau, the bodies and so on, when I was about 6 years old or so. But we had leaders who spoke to us, political leaders, and we could trust. America was very fortunate to have Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And he brought in people, both conservatives and communists, in his New Deal advisory, the people he listened to. When Huey Long, who was a nationalist and a populist, was gaining popularity, Roosevelt said to his advisor, "We don't have to worry about that because we're going to do what he's advocating. We have to meet the rural needs of people. We have to meet the real needs of people." This seems to me that since the death of Martin Luther King, the best we've heard from has probably been the last two popes. But the political leaders don't seem to have that depth.
Yep.
Maybe that's not fair. Maybe some of them that might have if they had the support, might have become their life.
And that's beyond my area of expertise, but I would want to close by saying this, Marvin. It seems to me that we are living through a crisis not only of economics and politics, but of meaning. And in light of our discussion, it seems to me the churches cannot and will not solve everything, but they can help recover practices of truth, compassion, courage, and hope. And as long as we faith communities do that, then that in itself is a great contribution for our young people.
Would you consider that's true of all faith communities if they follow the, if that's what they're trying to do?
I think all faith communities have the potential to do that.
Yeah.
But the reality is religion itself is very fragmented and divided along ideological and other lines. So religion itself is not a panacea or a solution. We need to put our own religious practices and traditions under the spotlight and severe self-examination.
Okay, thanks a lot, Graham.
You're welcome.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.